The island nation, or islands nation, of Turks and Caicos is located 600 miles southwest of Miami, near the southern edge of the end of the Bahamas. The islands were a British colony for years and considered to be part of Jamaica. For a time, they were treated as part of the Bahamas. In 1976, the UK granted them a form of self-rule. No more. Chicanery and deceit has undone the government of this nation of 30,000. In steps the crown to restore order. Joining me now is Mark Wilson of The Economist. His article on the situation in Turks and Caicos appeared in the August 20th edition of the magazine. I'm pleased to welcome him to today's Underreported. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Turks and Caicos have had what status in British eyes for the past 33 years?
Well, officially they're a United Kingdom overseas territory. There's still around 14 of these up and down the world, from the Antarctic to the Pacific, and half a dozen of them in the Caribbean.
Mostly tiny nations?
Mostly
tiny nations, tiny island nations?
Mostly absolutely tiny. The biggest is probably Bermuda in terms of population, and they range down to maybe 3,000 or 4,000 for Montserrat.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Montserrat. And in 1982, there was talk that maybe Turks and Caicos would become fully independent. Where'd that idea go?
Well, there's been talk of that right through. In fact, Britain's position has been since the 70s that any time the Turks and Caicos Islanders vote for it, it's just a question of finalizing a constitution and designing a flag. But so far, that hasn't cropped up in an election.
I hope flag design hasn't been a huge hurdle. That seems one that's not too hard to get over.
Well, they've already got one as an overseas territory, so that wouldn't be too hard.
Yeah.
It's just that I think in a lot of ways, even people who want quite a lot of autonomy in the islands find it's useful to have Britain there as a backstop.
And I think recent events have perhaps borne that out. Tell me what's going on with this inquiry that Britain launched into chicanery and theft among the government of Turks and Caicos.
Well, the inquiry is finished. There's been two, in a sense. There was a visit to the Turks and Caicos by the British Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee, which started in 2007. They reported in 2008 and recommended a more detailed full official inquiry, which was finished the report came out in July this year.
And what did it find?
Sorry?
What did it find?
Oh, what did it find? Well, it found, I think the most dramatic finding was that there was a high probability of systemic corruption, in the words of the report. It went through a number of areas, including tendering for construction contracts, sales of government land, general management of the economy, and there were specific findings about the former premier, Mike Misick, and four of his former cabinet ministers, which were that they should be investigated by the police, with a view to possible prosecution if there was enough evidence emerging for that to take place.
And I think the former premier has an ex-wife who's singing like a canary.
That's right. She gave quite ample evidence to the report, although I think even if she'd been dead quiet, there would have been plenty to go on with.
And you mentioned sale of government lands. To underline this a bit, sometimes people who don't have the right to sell these lands are selling them for 25 cents, 25 pence on the pound, as it were, just to pocket the profit, pure profit.
Well, what happens is that if you're a belonger, which is actually quite a small minority of the population, it's people who were born there, if you're a belonger, you've got the right to buy government land at 25% of its market value. And then you can sell it on to somebody else the next day and mm-hmm. make a substantial profit.
And so this was allowed by law, but what the inquiry found was that it shouldn't have been allowed.
It was allowed by law within certain conditions, and the inquiry found it was going on too much, and I think that selling it on to a developer would have certainly been against the intentions of the law, which was to allow everybody who was born locally to get a place to build their own home at a reasonable cost.
So you mentioned this phrase, this word, belonger. As I understand it, 7,000 of the population of 30,000 have a status of natives of Turks and Caicos. And so who is everyone else, and do they just go unrepresented in the government?
Well, there's slightly more than 7,000 who are belongers, but if you take the adult belongers who registered to vote, that's 7,000 out of a population of around 38,000. There's quite a lot more, but most of the extra ones are children. Yes, they're the ones who have the right to vote, and nobody else does under the present constitution.
And a lot of the other people are perhaps poor people from Haiti who emigrated to Turks and Caicos?
Well, there's two groups of others. One is actually quite wealthy people who might be from Britain, the States, Canada, or elsewhere, who are working in the offshore finance sector as lawyers, perhaps in the tourism industry as hotel managers. And the larger number, yes, they would be predominantly from Haiti, some from the Dominican Republic, some from other Caribbean islands, and doing, generally speaking, fairly low-grade jobs at fairly low pay.
Has the standard of living increased for Turks and Caicos over the last couple of decades?
Massively. They used to be dirt poor, and now they're, by Caribbean standards, fairly well off. In many recent years, GDP's grown by double-digit figures, over 10%. The unfortunate thing is that despite all that, because of mismanagement, the government doesn't seem to have any money.
Ah. So why is this worth the headache for the British?
Well, the islands are a British responsibility, ultimately. Something's got to be done. But one of the criticisms that's been made within the Turks and Caicos is that Britain was actually quite slow to step in.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest course is always not to rock the boat, to say, well, the locally elected people know best, let's give them their head. And I think Britain did that for a quite extended period. There was a report from the chief auditor on the government in 2005 and again in 2006, pointing up a whole lot of irregularities. But nothing was done. Nobody stepped in. There were a whole set of complaints to Whitehall from the islands. But again, the view was there's not enough evidence to really step in and do something.
So while Turks and Caicos are a British responsibility, does Britain get anything out of them? Is there anything that flows to Britain as a result, or is it just pure obligation that makes them feel they have to step in and sort things out when the government gets things wrong?
There's absolutely no benefit that I can see for Britain, certainly not in a financial sense of being there. And in contrast to France, it's not really even seen as a bonus in terms of national prestige and so on. But it's simply that with an empire that used to stretch right around the globe, all the larger territories got independence, and there were smaller ones left over, something had to happen. In general, they weren't in favor of independence because they realized they were too small. So by default, really, there was a continuing British connection.
We're speaking with Mark Wilson of The Economist, who's written about the situation in Turks and Caicos, that situation being that Great Britain has, that the United Kingdom has essentially removed the government of this small island nation. And what happens now? Does Britain rule it for how long? What's the plan?
Well, the inquiry recommends that most of the Constitution, not the entire Constitution, but most of the Constitution should be suspended for around 2 years. So that's the period they've got in mind. I think the idea is that at the end of that period, there would be a new Constitution, which on my count, I think, would be the sixth since the 1960s, and there would then be a move back towards self-government.
As I read the history of Turks and Caicos, there's a very interesting Canadian connection. Every once in a while, Canada makes noise. Sometimes it doesn't get taken seriously. Sometimes it dies in the Canadian Parliament. But every once in a while, Canada seems to imply maybe we'll take on Turks and Caicos. Why would Canada be interested in this island nation if they've been nothing but a responsibility for the British?
I think the noise really comes from the other directions. It's Turks and Caicos Islanders saying, hey, why don't we join Canada? And on and off, that's been a sentiment in the Caribbean, I think, going back more than a century. I think it was one of the proposals when the Treaty of Versailles was negotiated in 1919 that the British Caribbean territories should be passed from London to Ottawa. And I can see arguments for it, because there's always been a very strong Canadian-Caribbean connection going back at least 100 years. The Canadians are always seen as rather a benevolent outside force in the region. But I think these days, for the Turks and Caicos to join Canada isn't on the agenda at all. I don't think anybody in Canada would really want to take that on.
So the general sentiment among the people from the Turks and Caicos is, if anything, Britain should have intervened sooner. They don't feel like it's a colonization situation where they resent their overlords.
I wouldn't be able to say what the general sentiment is because I haven't talked to enough people. But I have noticed that since the announcement was made, which was knocking on for 2 weeks ago, we have not seen public protests. We haven't seen any objections, really, apart from a couple of the politicians who've been kicked out. So certainly the sentiment seems to be at least acquiescence in what's happened. And I think from a substantial number of people, it's welcomed.
Paul in New York left a comment on our show page strongly disagreeing, saying the world should be in an uproar. This is a flagrant breach of laws, rules, and protocols. It's an oppressive usurping of political power, power which belongs to the people of Turks and Caicos. Now, you paint a picture where the United Kingdom is saying we're only doing it because we have to. Who's right?
Well, in my view, the UK's right, but, I mean, Paul's entitled to his opinion.
Yeah.
And there would certainly be other people who share it. You know, we had some comments on that lineup on the Economist website during the week. But I think the only point where I would take issue is in terms of laws.
Yeah.
The existing constitution does specifically provide for Britain to step in as a last resort. There's absolutely nothing illegal or unconstitutional about this.
Is there some sort of sentiment that not only should Great Britain, you know, address the Turks and Caicos situation when it comes up, and perhaps another one of their small island territories when it comes up? Is there a sentiment that maybe there or a move afoot to unite all these little small territories that Britain still has responsibility for and administer them as one larger entity?
Nope. I don't think anyone suggests that. They're so small, so scattered, and so psychologically distinct from each other that it's absolutely not on the agenda. My personal view, and this is absolutely my own personal view, it's not a very widespread one, I think, is that over a generation or so, it would be a really good thing if there was a kind of convergence between the Turks and Caicos and Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's necessarily likely to happen. But it wouldn't be a bad thing for either country, I think.
Well, do you think that the Bahamians say to themselves, we are a functional government and we are getting along fine, we don't need to take on the Turks and Caicos? Do you think that that would be the stumbling block?
That is precisely what a lot of Bahamians would say. On the other hand, there are quite a lot of Bahamians of Turks and Caicos ancestry. Quite a lot of organizations such as the churches span both Bahamas and Turks and Caicos. They've got very similar economies based on dry little islands with not a lot of soil, but very good tourism and a little bit of an offshore finance industry. So in logic, there'd be no reason it shouldn't happen. But in the real world, I think it's unlikely.
Suki from Williamsburg left a comment on our show page asking, aside from Britain taking control of the islands, what can we expect for the island's future?
Uh-huh. Well, that's a big question, isn't it? I think one of the problems they've got over the next couple of years is a slightly rocky economy. They've depended on a tourism boom, and tourism is going to be down this year and last.
Mm-hmm.
And more than anything, hotel construction has been important, and or rather not hotel construction, resort construction. And the big component of that is sale of second and in some cases third homes to people in the U.S., and that's been down since, I think, 2007. So there's a bit of a downturn in the economy, and when you go from a breakneck boom to a little bit of a bust, I think that's problems all around, aside from any political difficulties.
And my last question is just pure piece of curiosity. How does an island in the Caribbean get named Turks?
That's nothing to do with people from Turkey, although there was a Turkish developer named in the report. It's actually because of the Turk's head Kakris, which has a little red hat on top. And some of the early settlers thought it looked like a Turk's head.
We've been speaking with Mark Wilson of The Economist on our underreported segment. We've been talking about Britain taking control of Turks and Caicos Islands. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is WNYC AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC FM. Join guest host Rosie Perez, yes, that Rosie Perez, for Friday's show. She'll talk to Brian Walsh of Time Magazine about the high cost of cheap food. Then iconic filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles on his latest project. Also, Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda discusses his latest film, Still Walking. Plus, our latest Please Explain is all about gut feelings. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Drew Katchen. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.